August the 8th, Friday, 77 degrees, going up to 89 today. And the heat, while terrible, has not been brutal. Let's put it that way. A 40% chance for showers through the weekend. And I don't see anything up and through next Saturday that would be over 90 degrees for a high, which is good. The humidity is still going to be ridiculous, and the tropics are quiet for the next 7 days, so we'll take it. That's all we can do at this time in hurricane season. Prashant Yadav joins us now, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, to talk about pharmaceutical tariffs. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, Tommy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for taking the time. Let's talk about what President Trump has proposed with an idea toward what?
So we have to acknowledge that the United States has a high degree of dependency on multiple pharmaceutical products that come largely imported from India, China, other countries in the world. And some of these are critical medicines. Our healthcare system, our hospitals, clinics, and patients depend critically on these medicines. And in case there is any shortage, which could be due to geopolitical events or trade embargoes or anything of that nature, can hamper the healthcare system's resilience, its ability to maintain continuity of care. So the idea is to make sure that we use the right policy instruments to bring back more manufacturing of critical medicines to the U.S., or at least to diversify it to come from multiple countries instead of being over-dependent on, let's say, China or India.
Are we, in your opinion, over-dependent right now on China and India?
For certain categories of medicines, yes, we are. One example is heparin, which is a blood thinner that I would say about a few million Americans take routinely for either chronic conditions or when they're going through a cardiovascular or the procedure as an IV. And there our dependence is very high on China as the supplier of the active ingredient, even though there are multiple manufacturers, including some in the United States, that make the finished product. But the active ingredient that goes into the finished product comes about 90 or 95% from China to these manufacturers. So that's one example. Amoxicillin, which is a staple for pediatric practices around the country, or many other antibiotics, the same issue repeats. We have either a very few select manufacturers in India or China, or even if we have a finished product manufacturer in the U.S., it gets all of its input in materials and ingredients from China. So the examples are very many, but we have a high degree of dependence on select critical medicines. That doesn't mean we have it on all the medicines. The higher-end medicines, so for example, cell and gene therapy, new modalities of treatment such as mRNA treatments, those are things, and higher-end biologics, cancer care, those are things that are made domestically in the U.S. They have been developed here. But more traditional and established medicines, generics, but also on-patent products that have been around for more than 10 years, those are the ones where we have a higher degree of dependency on imports.
Does it skew more toward those that are generic than are under patent?
Yes. So more of the generic medicines are imported from India and China, the reason being that the margins on these are very thin. And as a result, the cost of production becomes an important consideration in deciding where to source product from. So generic medicines are the ones where the dependency is much, much higher. But that doesn't mean it's only generic medicines. There are other products which are made, if not in India and China, let's say they're made in Europe, in Ireland, in Switzerland, and the U.S. imports them from those countries. And sometimes the reasons are for tax optimization. Sometimes the reasons are because the companies had set up a large plant in Europe, and instead of fragmenting their manufacturing network and having more than one factory, they want to keep supplying from a single factory because it helps them reduce costs in some ways.
So,
but to answer your question bluntly, yes, it is largely generic medicines.
So when it comes to these weight loss medications that so many people rely on, I'm a little bit confused because I know they have brand names, but I know there are people that provide these medications that are not the brand names. They are getting those from China. How does that work with other countries and patents medications, weight loss drugs, et cetera?
So for weight loss drugs, we have two that are authorized at the moment. One is a drug made by Eli Lilly and Company, and the other is made by Novo Nordisk. Mm-hmm. The drug from Novo Nordisk is manufactured to a larger extent in Europe. The drug from Eli Lilly is manufactured to a greater degree, or if not fully, in the U.S. But because the total supply has not been that high historically, many compounding pharmacies in the U.S. have started buying the active ingredient for these products and compounding them, essentially filling them into small vials that patients use. So it's become a market which consists of two manufacturers with production sites that are located, in one case, Novo Nordisk more in Europe, Eli Lilly more in the U.S., and then a number of compounding groups and pharmacies that have evolved. Now, as the total capacity from the original manufacturers, Lilly and Novo Nordisk, starts to expand, the role of the compounding pharmacies starts getting diluted because we may not need them. The manufacturers themselves can fulfill the demand. So that's the juncture at which the anti-obesity and the weight loss drug market is at currently.
I know you wrote a paper on tariffs, so we're going to talk about that in a second, but quickly to revisit these weight loss drugs for a second. So if it's a patent medication, how can a compounding pharmacy know what the recipe is?
So if it's a patented medicine, the company owns the patent to produce it, but in case there is a shortage of supply, which means the company cannot fulfill its entire demand in the country, we allow compounding pharmacies to manufacture. And when I say manufacture, I'm essentially talking about taking an active ingredient and filling it into a vial or into a capsule in some cases. That is legal, and that's what is happening for the obesity drugs. Now, there are lots of nuances in how the intellectual property plays out in such a scenario. Mm-hmm. How much royalties paid to the company? Do the companies authorize such a mechanism? I think that's a much more complex space, which requires a lot of nuance of intellectual property legislation.
I just wonder generally, so it's a patent medication, but the formula is available for compounding pharmacies if needed. Would that be accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about your paper on tariffs. Prashant Yadav is our guest, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll talk about President Trump's proposed tariffs on imported drugs. 621 traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 626 and a half, talking to Prashant Yadav, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. I know you wrote a 12-page letter on blanket tariffs on pharmaceutical imports. I could rumble and fumble and stumble my way through it, Prashant, but I think it's best just to let you give us maybe the overview and walk us through it.
So we want to start by saying that there is generally a problem in America's pharmaceutical supply chain, which is a high, extremely high in some cases, degree of dependence on China and in some cases companies in India. That problem is a national security risk. It is a health system resilience risk and needs to be addressed. We highlight examples, you know, in the periods when we, after 9/11, we had the anthrax attacks. We had to rely on ciprofloxacin, something which we considered to be a medicine of critical national security importance at that time. We remind people that today, a large portion of the supply of ciprofloxacin, that sort of key antibiotic we needed for anthrax, is now coming from India and China, and the active pharmaceutical ingredient of that is coming from China. So we do need some kind of policy action. But then we go into looking at, does a policy instrument that consists of blanket tariffs on all pharmaceuticals solve the problem? Or does it, in fact, create additional unintended consequences, such as will it create shortages of key generic medicines, where we've already had shortages many times in the past? These include injectable chemotherapy agents, other injectable generics that are sort of main staple use in a hospital setting. So I think our...
Are you talking about saline solution and things like that, Prashant?
Not just saline solution. Saline solution could be one of those, but also things such as, you know, injectable chemotherapy would be the best example of this. We've had multiple shortages. It comes from a few companies in India and China. So I think our key ask is we ought to solve this problem of high degree of dependence. It's important for national security. It's important for health system readiness. It's important for ensuring the quality of medicines that every American gets. But we've got to look at this with a range of policy instruments, not just tariffs. We need to think about what will incentivize a large global company to set up a generic manufacturing plant or other medicines manufacturing plant in the U.S. over the locations that they choose by themselves. When left to its own devices, the supply chain chooses locations that are best from a tax standpoint, that are best from an environmental compliance standpoint, that are best from capital investment standpoint. We've got to change that equation so that companies feel, oh, if I set up my new factory in Louisiana or in North Carolina, I'm going to be at least at par with what it would mean to set it up in another location in India or China or Europe or Ireland. So that's going to require a number of different policy instruments, government giving concessional loans, government gearing up the federal purchasing, whether it is for the VA system or for other government purchasing, DOD, making sure that it buys from a new company that sets up a plant in the United States. And that demand side needs to be addressed. Just tariffs alone, essentially, it's creating unpredictability for the companies to say, should I move my location to the U.S.? If I move it, what will be the implications? And doesn't necessarily create a strong and compelling business case for a company to move location, in particular for generic companies. Now, we have to admit that many companies in the last few months have announced large investments, both in manufacturing and in clinical development in the U.S. After the inauguration of President Trump. And these amount to hundreds of billions of dollars of new investment. But once again, we've got to keep in mind that this new investment that has been announced is largely coming into areas which are the high-end therapeutics, cell and gene therapy, advanced biologics, which are important. But these are areas where we don't have as high a degree of import dependence on India and China.
Thank you, Prashant. I appreciate your time and your insight. Prashant Yadav, Healthcare Supply Chain Expert, Council on Foreign Relations. It's a Rubik's Cube. We'll talk more when we come back. 6:31, 29 till 7. Time now, WWL First News. 6:46, 14 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. I was out playing tennis with Grady yesterday, and the mosquitoes drove me inside as well as the gnats. As a matter of fact, when I left today, he was sitting there looking at me like, and I don't know if your dogs have ever done this. They're looking at you like they can't wait for you to leave so they can get on the phone and start inviting friends over. Maybe I'm wrong. Aaron Ashbrook joins us now, assistant professor of peri-urban entomology at LSU. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm okay. Thanks for taking the time. Before we get to mosquitoes, man, you know, you're out there in the grass playing with the dog, doing whatever. I don't know if it's gnats or what it is, and I did notice, if you step back and look in the light, you know, with the filter and all that stuff, you can see these little white things flying around. Are those gnats? What are those?
Yeah, so we did have a lot of small gnats, these little space fly gnats that kind of, basically, they're really a kind of an annoyance. They fly in your face, they get in your nose, they get in your ears. They don't really want to bite you or do anything outside of just get on you. Mm-hmm. So we did have quite a bad year for those small little flies that like to fly up in your face.
Well, something's biting me on the legs. I know that. I don't know what it is because, man, I'm scratching like you don't know what after I'm out there playing in the grass with the dogs. So is it gnats or I don't think it's mosquitoes or what do you think?
So we did have some mosquitoes as well. So I wasn't sure if you were referring to some of the other small flies that we have within the state, but of course we do have plenty of mosquitoes that will bite as well.
I don't know what it was, but it didn't seem like mosquitoes, but man, I was had like 1,000 bites all over my legs that I was scratching, but not the point. Let's talk about mosquitoes. Are they getting worse in Louisiana?
So we do have some West Nile virus issues within the state. I would say as far as supporting mosquito control, I believe we are doing pretty good. Those agencies are doing pretty well in managing our mosquitoes. This year, some of the records I saw is that even though we do have some activity for West Nile virus this year, the overall threshold is lower than what we've had last year. And that's due to some of the work by these mosquito control districts, like those at St. Tammany Parish, you know, those in New Orleans, et cetera.
Does West Nile equal a decrease in less Nile equal a decrease in mosquitoes, or not necessarily?
So not necessarily. That's a really good question that you asked, Tommy. Essentially, what these districts are looking for is frequencies of infection within mosquito populations as well as animal populations. Mm-hmm. And so you could, in theory, see a decrease in West Nile virus activity and still have high mosquito populations.
So let me ask you a dumb question. I don't know if you know the answer or not, but when you see all the cattle in the fields and so forth as you drive by, I would presume the mosquitoes are just going to town on them, or not, because maybe their hide's too thick. What about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so you're right. They do. The mosquitoes do go for those cattle that you'll see out there on the highway. Some mosquitoes, some of the more nuisance-type mosquitoes can be really bad for the cattle, like the salt marsh mosquitoes. They can be very bad for some of these cattle out in the more plains-type environments within the state. So not necessarily involved with disease transmission. However, those mosquitoes can be very problematic for our livestock.
Yeah, it would just seem like if I'm a cow and I'm standing out there, other than my tail, you know, which I can use to swat stuff away within that radius, it would seem like I'd be covered with mosquitoes because they can just suck as much blood out of me until I'm dry. Am I making stuff up?
Yeah, no, I've heard of that before.
Really?
I have heard of cattle being exsanguinated by mosquitoes. I don't know if it was a true report or not, but I have heard of it happening before.
Wow.
Within the state.
Every now and then, a squirrel that can't see finds a nut, right? 6:50, 10 till 7, we're going to talk about preventing mosquitoes when we come back. I'm going to tell you all what, real quick before we go, I'm going to tell you something about 5-gallon buckets that you probably may not have realized when we return. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Ashbrook on this Friday morning, assistant professor of peri-urban entomology about mosquitoes and why they're so bad. Even a bottle cap of water can lead to breeding grounds for mosquitoes. And what I was saying about the buckets earlier, Aaron, is I'm a 5-gallon bucket guy. I just like to put stuff in buckets, right? But I realized flipping these buckets over to keep the rain out and keep them from collecting water, there are numerous sections, if you will, partitions and on the bottom of these buckets that people don't realize they're not smooth, that could collect water and still create breeding grounds for mosquitoes.
That's correct. Any small container that can hold just a few milliliters of water, just enough for larval mosquitoes to be in there and grow and develop, as well as to maintain algae for them to feed upon, that is good enough for them to grow in, you know. I also have a tendency to find mosquito larvae in the saucers of my potted plants, just holding just a little bit of water, and they're down there breeding.
That's why you should never have potted plants. You should always have concrete. But along those lines, when it comes to people having stuff outdoors and it raining every afternoon, I don't know how you keep up with that. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say if you can, bring some of those items indoors. Maybe you could set them up in such a way that they drain more readily. You know, I kind of have a lot of my thing, a lot of my porch items kind of bought back. And then when I want to bring them out, I then will pull them off the patio. And so that way they're not collecting as much water, but it's a constant battle.
What is the role of weather play in this? What happens when it gets extremely hot, when it gets cold? I don't recall seeing any mosquitoes when it snowed, but I don't know if that's just because of the seasonal thing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So essentially, mosquito activity is weather-driven to the point where we can even talk about what are referred to as mosquito days, where essentially these are days where the temperature and humidity are ideal for mosquitoes and their development. So as temperatures increase, mosquitoes actually will grow faster, so it accelerates their development time. And so, of course, in Louisiana, when it gets hot, that's something that we're encountering. And, of course, the rain Mosquitoes, their larvae, they need water to survive and develop into adults. And so when we have a lot of rain, that also creates conditions that are good for breeding. So we not only accelerate their development, but we have placed a lot of locations where mosquitoes can breed.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but by my perception is it's been a rainy summer, and I'm just wondering, are we winning or are the mosquitoes winning? Is it getting worse?
Well, you know, it's the good work of our mosquito control districts that are keeping our mosquitoes at bay, and I would say that we are winning the battle as much as we can.
What would you tell people to do to protect themselves from mosquitoes?
Yeah, that's another great question. So I kid you not, Tommy, when I go out in the woods, I bring heavy DEET with me, or the DEET heavy woods, because, you know, you apply it, it works for a while, mm-hmm. It seems to go away, whether it's getting washed off by water, humidity, sweat, and so then you start getting bit by mosquitoes again. So I always carry the repellent with me and then reapply it as I need. You can wear loose-fitting clothes, and that also helps protect you a little bit in that mosquitoes they're easier to bite you if you're wearing tight-fitting clothes. They can kind of penetrate through those fibers. And there are a variety of repellents that are available. You just want to make sure that you're using one that's approved by the EPA because they actually test it and make sure that it works.
Aaron, if I can leave you with two thoughts, and I would never pretend to give a professor advice, but they would be get rid of the potted plants and go with concrete and stay out of the woods, stay indoors.
Hey, I like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron Ashbrook. I appreciate your time and your insight as always. Assistant Professor of Urban Peri-Urban Entomology at LSU. We're talking about vaping. When we come back, you think it's better than smoking. Might be a little bit better, but not a whole lot better. We'll talk about that when we return on WWL.